Dr. Godfrey.
I'm afraid that for at least several members in this group, what I have to say today will not come as a surprise. In fact, I know that Lou and Bert and June and several other people had to read my presentation in a more condensed form, which will be coming out in the next issue of the RRR. I should also indicate that at least the conceptual thrust of my remarks will also be found in a book that I am hoping to bring to completion in the next several months, called After Liberalism, which is a study of the managerial therapeutic state as the dominant political model of the 20th century, or as I point out, the victorious political model of the 20th century. It has destroyed or outlasted all of its managerial competitors. In his more exasperated moments, Murray Rothbard used thunder against what he called the anti-Semitic smearbund. Murray meant by that the organized efforts of liberal and neocon journalists to treat uncongenial viewpoints as self-evidently anti-Jewish. In his response to the assaults on Pat Buchanan during the Republican presidential distinguishing characteristics of these unfair broadsides, one, their authors said pretty much the same things cast in the same phrases, despite their usual attempts to appear ideologically distinct. Charles Krauthammer, John Leo, Richard Cohn, and William Raspberry all could have written each other's columns about Buchanan's putative dark side. Two, none of their attacks could demonstrate that Buchanan manifested hatred of Jews as opposed to disagreeing with opinions that most American Jews held. That is, Buchanan took positions that were anti-liberal and critical of the American Zionist lobby. His anti-Semitism was therefore to be inferred. In contrast to what past generations assumed to be anti-Semitism, this way, okay, namely explicit statements of revulsion toward Jews as a group. It is suggested perhaps most often by the Anti-Defamation League that since the Holocaust, anti-Semites cannot afford to be as brazen as they once were. In the face of this catastrophe caused by anti-Semitic bigotry, Jew haters have had to change their tone. They do not vilify Jews openly any longer, but resort to a coded language, which is accessible to other bigots. Instead of declaiming against Jews, the new anti-Semites, as depicted by Norman Podoritz, Ruth Weissey, and Abe Foxman of the Anti-Defamation League, criticize Israel. They rant against Israeli hardliners who resist the peace talks with the PLO and single out Israeli acts of brutality committed against Palestinians. These new anti-Semites obviously include those who question the established accounts of the Holocaust, but are also said to embrace others. In a long brief published last summer by ADL, it's right who are alleged to be the major source of American anti-Semitism. Beneath their stern criticism of the feminist and gay agendas, we are urged to look for nativist and anti-Jewish sentiments. In the guilt by association method favored by ADL and by the American Jewish Congress, failure to go along with liberal social agendas betrays an unacknowledged hostility toward Jews. This inferential approach to anti-Semitism operates in the absence of proof, and it manufactures tests for its assertions that have more to do with the tester's political peeves than with those anti-Semitic attitudes we are supposed to go in search of. It might be asked, why should a Christian society in which Jews have prospered, and in which Christians indeed have spilled blood fighting Nazi persecutors of the Jews, now feel obliged to tread softly in talking about Jewish concerns? Why do American Christians strain not to give offense to American Jewish groups when they gladly blame themselves for every conceivable social and cultural ill? The reason is not that American Jews have suffered in the New World more than other European settlers. Almost all Catholic ethnics and some Protestant ones like Scandinavians in the Midwest labored under the same disabilities and in some cases far longer than the children of the Eastern European Jewish immigrants who came at the turn of the century. One sometimes forgets that restrictions at universities were aimed not only at Jews, but were also aimed at Catholics and other groups. And indeed, as has been pointed out, the restrictiveness of those conditions were worse for other groups because the 5 or 10% quota that was open to Jews was also open to Catholics, although there was a much larger number of Catholics who were living in the United States and may well have been applying for some of those positions. Nonetheless, one only hears about these restrictions in terms of American Jews. who one might say have done better than American, or at least until recently were doing better than American. I think by now these income differences are probably very slight. But the question to be asked is why is greater verbal restraints applied to American Jews than to American Christians? Does this really reveal an unsubdued anti-Semitism? Or to the contrary, far more sensitivity to Jewish feelings than to those of Christians? Why then does this double standard continue to be applied to the two groups? In one of my contributions to the RRR, I discussed the bizarre obligation felt by the head of the Christian Coalition, Ralph Reed, who in a speech last spring to the Anti-Defamation League made a startlingly counterfactual confession. Reed ruefully observed that American Christians were not sufficiently aware of their complicity as Christians in both the Holocaust and the Spanish Inquisition. I have to tell you that when I read this in the New York Times, I thought that my eyesight was failing me. I could not figure out why a Southern Baptist descended from English is responsible for something done by a Spanish Catholic monarchy in the 15th century. But obviously, other people thought it was entirely appropriate. Reed's confession won the approval of Mona Charon, Cal Thomas, and other neocon regulars. And the New York Times commentator Frank Rich approved of what Reed said, but also pointed out that he was offering too little too late. It is clear by now that what Buchanan called the branding iron of anti-Semitism is a form of defamation to be turned against anyone whom the defamer intends to get even with. It also comes with a carefully reserved right. If a consistent standard of discouraging prejudice were being applied, then the anti-Southern and anti-Christian bigotry which reveals itself on primetime TV would receive more critical notice than the inferential anti-Semitism being described. Allow me to cite a case in point. Well, I want to say more than a case. I want to say two cases in point, which come readily to mind. One is a study that I've been doing of the French right. And there have been a number of articles and even books discussing l'extrême droite en France, the extreme right, as opposed to la droite classique, which is really the social democrats or the centrists. One is always warned in all these French books that the extreme right is violently anti-Semitic and at least fascisante, means like the fascist, if not explicitly fascist. Then one looks around for evidence of this, and the evidence is extremely exiguous. There are no Nazi members that I know of in the Front National in France. I mean, they would have been, you know, in diapers during the Second World War. The most they could show is that there were people who belonged to groups that at one time had supported the Vichy government in France, who are now voting for the Front National or may make up, you know, the électeurs, the people who vote for it. But there is no indication that they're Nazi. Well, then, of course, the final evidence is they want to control immigration. And this is a perfect example of what I call inferential anti-Semitism. If you don't like somebody's politics, that, you know, if they're insensitive, the person must obviously be an anti-Semite. It's ipso facto anti-Semitic. The other example, which is perhaps a more detailed one, comes from a society much like our own, but far worse in some ways, a much more developed therapeutic culture, namely that of Canada. In Canada, there are federal and various provincial human rights codes that make it a criminal offense to publicize views treating anyone, quote, and I quote from the 1992 Ontario Law Against Hate Crimes, anyone who speaks or publishes anything indicating that anyone is inferior for religious, racial, ethnic, gender, or sexual reasons. Both German and Austrian groups tried to test these laws in Ontario by bringing suit against Edgar Bronfman, head of the Canadian Jewish Congress, in 1989, and against author Elie Wiesel in 1992. Both plaintiffs had used highly inflammatory language to express their hatred for Germans and Austrians. Indeed, Wiesel had spoken of a Jewish duty to hate Germans, to reserve a place in their hearts for Teutonophobia, in a book that he published in 1982. But both suits were thrown out, unlike other more numerous ones brought against alleged hate criminals by Canadian Jewish organizations. Over 40% of the suits brought against individual authors or against the distribution of particular books in the province of Ontario under its criminal code dealing with hate speech and hate literature can be traced to three Jewish organizations: the Simon Wiesenthal Center, the Canadian Jewish Congress, and Canadian B'nai B'rith. On the basis of a detailed report by Barbara Kolaska of these and other hate crime suits, and from my own reading of the bulletins of the Canadian Association for Free Expression, which is like CAFE, it's CAF, is the anagram, it seems that fewer than half of these suits against anti-Semites have targeted so-called Holocaust deniers. Though the most widely publicized suits have involved such Holocaust polemicists as Ernst Sundel and David Irving, others fall into the category of inferential anti-Semitism. In some instances, Canadian Jewish organizations have gone after politically incorrect figures without fighting court battles. Thus, leading Canadian B'nai B'rith spokesman David Mattis called for the dismissal of J. Philip Rushton in 1989 while speaking at Rushton's University, Western Ontario. According to Mattis, Rushton expressed witch doctor views in his discussion of the cognitive and behavioral differences among the races, and was therefore unfit to teach at a Canadian university. Mattis compared Rushton to David Irving and contrasted Western Ontario's failure to sack Rushton to Carleton University's admirable action. Carleton and Ottawa had withdrawn a speaking invitation to Irving after learning of his revisionist writings on the Holocaust. Unless my memory fails, I think Irving had a hell of a time crossing the border from Niagara Falls into Canada, because they threatened to arrest him as soon as he set foot in Canada under these hate speech laws. I suppose this would be a kind of preemptive strike against him before he would commit the hate speech in Canada. The Canadian Jewish Congress and the Canadian B'nai B'rith have also assailed Paul Frum, the Toronto school teacher who happens to head CAF. They put pressure on Frum's school board and on the Ontario Ministry of Education to have him dismissed and his teaching certificate revoked. The grounds are Frum's supposed anti-Semitism, as seen from his defense of academic freedom, and his classroom use of Judeo-Christian. Bernie Farber, one of the heads of the Canadian Jewish Congress, maintains in interviews with the Toronto Star that the defense of intellectual freedom is, quote, now a mask for neo-Nazi activity. Farber has also criticized the term Judeo-Christian as, quote, culturally limiting and offensive to third world immigrants, unquote. In the most bizarre case of inferential anti-Semitism known to me, the Canadian Jewish Congress in 1994 managed to stop the distribution of a monthly put out by the French Catholic Pèlerins de Saint-Michel, the Pilgrims of St. Michael in the Rougemont, Quebec. The Michael Journal urged readers to establish a distributist economy in accordance with Catholic social teaching. Its neo-scholastic position was apparently intolerable to the Canadian Jewish Congress, which insisted that the journal was really warning Catholics not to do business with Jews. The Congress first prepared a suit and then appealed directly to the federal government to shut down the offending monthly. Though its charge was never proved, Federal Public Works Minister David Dingwall ordered that further delivery of the Michael Journal be suspended. Dingwall condemned, quote, this vile and disgusting expression of hate toward the Jewish people, unquote, that he claimed pervaded the publication. But as its editor Alain de Pilote explained in his undistributed, it was an undistributed retort since they closed down any further distribution of publication, the journal addressed monetary issues without venting hate upon anyone. For balance, one should note that older Canadian Jews may recall a time when anti-Semitism did exist among French Canadian leaders and was in fact expressed. Moreover, many Canadian Jews are either victims of Nazi persecution or descended from such victims, and it may be inevitable in today's political climate that they fall easy prey to radical demagogues claiming to save them from covert anti-Semitism. Nonetheless, one has to stretch the term anti-Semite beyond any historically recognizable meaning to apply it to the Michael Journal or to CAF. Minister Dingwall's statements exemplifies the cowardly response to arrogant victimologists which one expects from contemporary public figures. Concede the charge of prejudice, as Ralph Reed did in addressing the ADL, and hope the accusers turn elsewhere for their blood sports. Why Christians pursue this course in a society in which they remain the supposed majority is a question the answer to which may have to await for the appropriate pathologist. Put most bluntly, the Christian world has gone from picking on Jews to encouraging them and other non-Christians to treat the majority religion with contempt. Christians have become a Nietzschean invention, a moving target of cultural masochists. But beyond that historical problem is another revisionist, another relevant one that I've studied in more depth in the book that I'm now completing, the continuing relation between anti-Semitism, vaguely defined, and the therapeutic state. In the late 40s, the American Jewish Committee, which would soon launch Commentary, began subsidizing the research and publication of a series of sociological tracts, Studies in Prejudice. The best publicized work in the series, The Authoritarian Personality, came out in 1950 and set the tone for subsequent volumes. Reams of research were tendentiously presented to demonstrate, in the words of series editor Daniel Levinson, quote, that anti-Semitism remains the major threat to American democratic institutions, unquote. By the way, I think one could devote an entire volume to trying to deconstruct or explain democratic in that term, because it has nothing to do with self-government. It has to do with people being properly conditioned and sensitized to listen to those like Daniel Levinson, who would like to reconstruct them and their families. In retrospect, this assertion seems wildly exaggerated. What might be more accurately said is that while anti-Semitism was a disappearing social problem in post-war America, it was an obsession among the New York Jewish sociologists, Daniel Levinson, Seymour Morton Lipset, Ilse Frankel, and Paul Lazarfield, who contributed to the Studies in Prejudice. Memories of the Nazis and of European anti-Semitism clouded their judgment and led them to overstate the dangers existing for Jews in the United States. But far more importantly, their work has less to do with anti-Jewish prejudice than with their own social agenda. All of the contributors were socialists and social engineers who saw a need for a larger and more intrusive central government. They spoke about economic democracy, resocialization, and as Christopher Lash notes in The True and Only Heaven, combined talk about a worker state with profound hatred for ordinary blue-collar Americans. In the early 50s, Seymour Morton Lipset and his close friend Richard Hofstadter stressed the urgent need to educate American workers in order to prepare them for social democracy. Most troubling to these social commentators were the retrograde attitudes which they encountered outside of their own social world, particularly in the South and among Catholic ethnics. These political and cultural judgments shaped the view of anti-Semitism presented in the studies. Their anti-Semitism is the label given to whatever the authors happen to dislike. In The Authoritarian Personality, opposition to the New Deal, distaste for homosexuality, and a patriarchal view of the family are all correlated with anti-Semitism. Indeed, they all become infallible expressions of anti-Semitism. These positions are treated as, quote, pathological, and in the later sections of the volume related to, quote, the predisposition to crime, unquote. Having plowed through most of the AP, The Authoritarian Personality, it is hard for me to discern any of those connections that the contributors are intent on establishing or simply presume. In the case of one interviewee, Mack, Adorno infers a high degree of anti-Semitism from a chance observation that Jews are sometimes clannish. Here we encounter an early instance of inferential anti-Semitism. Given that Mack is a Democrat having second thoughts about the New Deal, it is necessary to conclude that he must also hate Jews. Adorno makes the same interviewee typify the pseudo-democrat, the kind of person who sided with Nazi big business against the Weimar Republic. Such a person, by definition, despises Jews, New Dealers, bureaucrats, and other outsiders. That's a direct quotation from this illustrious work. It is, of course, impossible, given the analytic framework, to disagree with any of these conclusions, particularly the social policies, without appearing anti-Semitic. Adorno and his fellow contributors insulate themselves against criticism by pathologizing dissent. The more fundamentally one disagrees with their presentation, and particularly with its badly disguised and imperious values, the more anti-Jewish, i.e., mentally sick, one is assumed to be. To be doubly sure that all readers agree with these judgments, The Authoritarian Personality provides an expedient term of contempt for someone who questions its policies, pseudo-democrat. This conflicted individual, we are warned, cannot embrace social engineering and government economic planning, but pretends to be a Democrat nonetheless. One of the important characteristics, or critical characteristics of this analysis, is by what is by now the prevalent dissociation of democracy from self-government. Democracy is not about people governing themselves or communities controlling their own destiny. Democracy is about people being sensitized by governments together with behavioral experts. And that is the only definition of democracy that I can find in this 450 dreary pages which make up The Authoritarian Personality. The Studies in Prejudice series, in any case, helped create a style of discourse which still characterizes our journalism. It incorporates into a single text a multitude of special concerns by appealing to an unproved national danger. The danger does not require substantiation to be appealed to, rather to something to be believed because of its usefulness in building coalitions and in empowering the state to interfere in the lives of individuals and families. From social psychologists and public administration, and I'm afraid by now Zionist organizations, there are groups that stand to benefit from crusades against anti-Semitism. The more loosely the term is bandied about, the wider will be the range of beneficiaries. The painting of a single swastika on a building anywhere in the U.S. will bring together, as happened in Lancaster 2 years ago when a synagogue door was spray-painted, a broad coalition of ideological and vocational interests. Almost all of these interests, from government agents tracking extremists to the National Gay and Lesbian Alliance and various Jewish lobbies, thrive from defining and combating hate crimes. The more dramatic the hate being shown or alleged, the more easily their own activities can be justified, and the more necessary is made to appear the special measures they advocate to deal with the hatred in our hearts, e.g. intervention in the classroom by social psychologists to banish youthful prejudice, and further civil rights legislation. Both were proposed in our newspapers and by therapeutic lobbyists to preclude the possibility of hate crimes. One final observation may be required for assessing the long-term impact of the studies in prejudice. A widely distributed and heavily praised work, it both reflected and seemed to confirm the fiction that anti-Semitism is the keystone of American bigotry. All other prejudices, we are told, are somehow derivative from this one. And if we look deep enough into a homophobe, devout Christian, would-be patriarch, or critic of socialism, there lurks a troubled anti-Semitic soul. In this grouping together of all positions odious to the American left as symptoms of anti-Semitism, the studies established a precedent. It is unhappily one that continues to be practiced and not likely to vanish soon. In Canada, I would point out, it was not a Christian journalist, but a Jewish one, Eric Margolid of the Toronto Sun, who published a blistering tirade against Ontario's hate speech laws. Margolid also went on to scold his fellow Jews for making scandalous use of them. In view of the terror of the anti-Semitic branding iron experienced by American and Canadian Christians, the non-Christian source of this protest is not surprising. Needless to say, Jewish journalists in Israel do not live with a similar dread of being called anti-Muslim, nor should they, any more than should American or Canadian Christians fear the anti-Semitic label if they're telling you the truth. A commonly made criticism about those who catch hell after being politically incorrect or being declared such by the media is that their wounds are self-inflicted. This is true in a vastly different sense for a society that has lost the will to survive. Step by step, it abandons its freedom as well as its dignity. Thank you.